Wind Will Rove by Sarah Pinsker. Narrated by Karen Chilton.
There's a story about my grandmother, Wendy, one I never asked her to confirm or deny, in which she took her fiddle on a spacewalk. There are a lot of stories about her, fewer of my parents' generation, fewer still of my own, though we're in our 50s now and old enough that if there were stories to tell, they would probably have been told. My grandmother was an engineer, part of our original crew. According to the tale, she stepped outside to do a visual inspection of an external panel that was giving anomalous readings. Along with her tools, she clipped her fiddle and bow to her suit's belt. When she completed her task, she paused for a moment, tethered to our ship the size of a city, put her fiddle to the place where her helmet met her suit and played, "Wind Will Rove" into the void. Not to be heard, of course, just to feel the song in her fingers. There are a number of things wrong with this story, starting with the fact that we don't do spacewalks, for reasons that involve laws of physics I learned in school and don't remember anymore. Our shields are too thick, our velocity is too great, something like that. The blackout didn't touch ship records. Crew transcripts and recordings still exist, and I've listened to all the ones that might pertain to this legend. She laughs her deep laugh. She teases a tired colleague about his date the night before. She even hums "Wind Will Rove" to herself as she works. But there are no gaps, no silences unexplained. Even if it were possible, her gloves would have been too thick to find a fingering. I doubt my grandmother would have risked losing her instrument, out here where any replacement would be synthetic. I doubt, too, that she'd have exposed it to the cold of space. Fiddles are comfortable at the same temperatures people are comfortable. They crack and warp when they aren't happy. Her fiddle. My fiddle now. My final evidence. Wind Will Rove is traditionally played in DDAD tuning, with the first and fourth strings dropped down. As much as she loved that song, she didn't play it often, since retuning can make strings wear out faster. If she had risked her fiddle, if she had managed to press her fingers to its fingerboard, to lift her bow, to play, she wouldn't have played a DDAD tune. This is as incontrovertible as the temperature of the void. And yet, the story is passed on among the ship's fiddlers, and I pass it on again as I write this narrative for you, Taylor, or whoever else discovers it. And yet her nickname, Wendy, first appears in transcripts starting in the fifth year on board. Before that, people called her Beth or Green. She loved the song, I know that much. She sang it to me as a lullaby. At 12, I taught it to myself in traditional GDAE tuning. I took pride in the adaptation, pride in the hours I spent getting it right. I played it for her on her birthday. She pulled me to her, kissed my head. She always smelled like the lilacs in the greenhouse. She said, "Rosie, I'm so tickled that you do that for me, and you played it note perfectly, which is a gift to me in itself. But Wind Will Rove is a DDAD tune, and it ought to be played that way. You play it in another tuning, it's a different wind that blows." I'd never contemplated how there might be a difference between winds. I'd never felt one myself, unless you counted air pushed through vents or the fan on a treadmill. After the birthday party, I looked up wind and read about breezes and gales and shirocos, about haboobs and zephyrs. Great words, words to turn over in my mouth, words that spoke to nothing in my experience. The next time I heard the song in its proper tuning, I closed my eyes and listened for the wind. Windy Grove, traditional. Believed to have traveled from Scotland to Cape Breton in the 19th century. Lost. Wind Will Rove, instrumental in D. Alternate tuning, DDAD. Harriet Berry, music historian. The fiddler, Olivia Vandiver, and her father, Charlie Vandiver, came up with this tune in the wee hours of a session in 1974. Charlie was trying to remember a traditional tune he had heard as a boy in Nova Scotia, believed to be Windy Grove. No recordings of the original Windy Grove were ever cataloged, on ship or on earth. Wind Will Rove is treated as traditional in most circles, even though it's relatively recent, because it is the lost tune's closest known relative. The four-deck wreck has the best acoustics of any room on the ship. There's a nearly identical space on every deck, but the others don't sound as good. The wrecks were designed for gatherings, but no acoustic engineer was ever consulted. And there's nobody on board with that specialty now. The fact that one room might sound good and another less so wasn't important in the grander scheme. It should have been. In the practical, the day-to-day, it matters. It matters to us. Choirs perform there, and bands. It serves on various days and nights as home to a Unitarian church, a capoeira joda, a Reconstructionist synagogue, a mosque, a Quaker meeting house, a half dozen different African dance groups, and a Shakespearean theater, everyone clinging on to whatever they hope to save. The room is scheduled for weeks and months and years to come, though weeks and months and years are all arbitrary designations this far from Earth. On Thursday nights, Four Deck Rec hosts The Old Time, thanks to my grandmother's early pressure on the recreation committee. There are only a few of us on board who know what old time refers to, since everything is old time, strictly speaking. Everyone else has accepted a new meaning, since they have never known any other. An old time is a Thursday night, is a hall with good acoustics, is a gathering of fiddlers and guitarists and mandolinists and banjo players. It has a verb form now. Are you old-timing this week? If you are a person who would ask that question or a person expected to respond, the answer is yes. You wouldn't miss it. On this particular Thursday night, while I wouldn't miss it, my 10th graders had me running late. We'd been discussing the 20th and 21st century space races, and the conversation had veered into dangerous territory. I'd spent half an hour trying to explain to them why Earth history still mattered. This had happened at least once a cycle with every class I'd ever taught, but these particular students were as fired up as any I remembered. "I'm never going to go there, right, Ms. Clay?" Nelson Odell had asked. This class had only been with me for 2 weeks, but I'd known Nelson his entire life. His great-grandmother, my friend Harriet, had dragged him to the old time until he was old enough to refuse. He'd played mandolin, his stubby fingers well fit to the tiny neck, face set in a permanently resentful expression. "No," I said. "This is a one-way trip. You know that." "And really, I'm just going to grow up and die on this ship, right? And all of us, you too, die, not grow up. You're already old." I had heard this from enough students. I didn't even wince anymore. Yes, to all of the above, though it's a reductive line of thinking, and that last bit was rude. "Then what does it matter that back on Earth a bunch of people wanted another group had? Wouldn't it be better not to teach us how people did those things and get bad ideas in our heads?" Emily Redhorse, beside Nelson, said, They make us learn it all so we can understand why we got on this ship. She was the only current old-time player in this class, a promising fiddler. Old-time players usually understood the value of history from a young age. Nelson waved her off. "We didn't get on the ship. Our grandparents and great-grandparents did. And here we are learning things that were old to them." "Because, stupid." That was Trina Nguyen. I interrupted. "Debate is fine, Trina. Name-calling is not." "Because, Nelson," she tried again, "there aren't new things in history. That's why it's called history." Nelson folded his arms and stared straight at me. "Then don't teach it at all. If it mattered so much, why did they leave it behind? Give us another hour to learn more genetics or ship maintenance or farming, things we can actually use." "First of all, history isn't static. People discovered artifacts and primary documents all the time that changed their views on who we were. It's true that the moment we left Earth, we gave up the chance to learn anything new about it from newly discovered primary sources, but we can still find fresh perspectives on the old information." I tried to regain control, hoping that none of them countered with the blackout. Students of this generation rarely did. To them, it was just an incident in shipboard history, not the living specter it had been when I was their age. I continued. "Secondly, Emily is right. It's important to know why and how we got here. The conventional wisdom remains that those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it." "How are we supposed to repeat it?" Nelson waved at the pictures on the walls. "We don't have countries or oil or water or guns or swords or bombs. If teachers hadn't told us about them, we wouldn't even know they existed. We'd be better off not knowing that my ancestors tried to kill Emily's ancestors, wouldn't we? Somebody even tried to erase all of that entirely, and you made sure it was still included in the new version of history." "Not me, Nelson. That was before my time." I knew I shouldn't let them get a rise out of me, but I was tired and hungry, not the ideal way to start a 7-hour music marathon. "Enough. I get what you're saying, but not learning this is not an option. Send me 1,000 words by Tuesday on an example of history repeating itself." Before anyone protested, I added, "You were going to have an essay to write either way. All I've done is change the topic. It doesn't sound like you wanted to write about space races." They all grumbled as they plugged themselves back into their games and music and shuffled out the door. I watched them go, wishing I'd handled the moment differently, but not yet sure how. It fascinated me that Nelson was the one fomenting this small rebellion when his great-grandmother ran the Old Time Memory Project. My grandmother was the reason I obsessed over history, why I'd chosen teaching. Harriet didn't seem to have had the same effect on Nelson. As Nelson passed my desk, he muttered, "Maybe somebody needs to erase it all again." "Stop," I told him. He turned back to face me. I still had several inches on him, but he held himself as if he were taller. The rest of the students flowed out around him. Trina rammed her wheelchair into Nelson's leg as she passed, in a move that looked 100% deliberate. She didn't even pretend to apologize. "I don't mind argument in my classroom, but don't ever let anyone hear you advocating another blackout." He didn't look impressed. "I'm not advocating. I just think teaching us Earth history, especially broken history, is a waste of everybody's time." "Maybe someday you'll get on the education committee and you can argue for that change. But I heard you say erase it all again. That isn't the same thing. Would you say that in front of Harriet? Maybe I was just exaggerating. It's not even possible to erase everything anymore. And there's plenty of stuff I like that I wouldn't want to see erased. He shrugged. I didn't mean it. Can I go now? He left without waiting for me to dismiss him. I looked at the walls I'd carefully curated for this class. 10th grade had always been the year we taught our journeys, political and scientific antecedents. It was one of the easier courses for the Education Committee to recreate accurately after the blackout, since some of it had still been in living memory at the time, and one of the easier classrooms to decorate for the same reason. I'd enlarged images of our ship's construction from my grandmother's personal collection, alongside reproductions of news headlines. Around the top of the room, a static quote from United Nations Secretary General Confidence Soiree. We have two missions now, to better the Earth and to better ourselves. Normally, I'd wipe my classroom walls to neutral for the continuing education group that met there in the evening. But this time I left the wall displays on when I turned off the lights to leave. Maybe we'd all failed these children already if they thought the past was irrelevant. The digital art on the street outside my classroom had changed during the day. I traced my fingertips along the wall to get the info. A reimagining of a memory of a photo of an Abdoulaye Konaté mural, sponsored by the Malian Memory Project. According to the description, the original had been a European transit station mosaic, though they no longer knew which city or country had commissioned it. Fish swam across a faux-tiled sea. Three odd blue figures stood tall at the far end, bird-like humanoids. The colors were soothing to me, but the figures less so. How like the original was it? No way to tell. Another reinvention to keep some version of our past present in our lives. I headed back to my quarters for my instrument and a quick dinner. There was always food at the old time. But I knew from experience that if I picked up my fiddle, I wouldn't stop playing until my fingers begged. My fingers and my stomach often had different agendas. I needed a few minutes to cool down after that class, too. Nelson had riled me with his talk of broken history. To me, that had always made preserving it even more important. But I understood the point he was trying to make. By the time I got to the four-deck rec, someone had already taken my usual seat. I tuned in the corner where everyone had stashed their cases, then looked around to get the lay of the room. The best fiddlers had nabbed the middle seats, with spokes of mandolin and banjo and guitar and less confident fiddlers radiating out. The only proficient old-time bass player, Doug Kelly, stood near the center, with the ship's only upright bass. A couple of his students sat behind him, ready to swap out for a tune or two if he wanted a break. The remaining empty seats were all next to banjos. I spotted a chair beside Dana Torres from the ship's advisory council. She was a good administrator and an adequate banjo player. She kept time, anyway. I didn't think she'd show up if she were less than adequate. Nobody wants to see leadership failing at anything. She had taken a place two rings removed from my usual seat in the second fiddle tier. Not the innermost circle where my grandmother had sat, with the players who call the tunes and call the stops. At 55 years old, I hadn't earned a spot there yet. Still, I sat just outside them and kept up with them, and it had been a long time since I'd caught a frown from the leaders. A tune started as I made my way to the empty chair. Honeysuckle. A thought crossed my mind that Harriet had started Honeysuckle without me, one of my memory project tunes, to punish me for being late. A second thought crossed my mind, mostly because of the conversation with my students, that probably only three other people in the room knew or cared what Honeysuckle was. Tom and Vovo, who maintained the seed bank, Liat Schuster, who worked in the greenhouse. In all our nights together, I never thought to ask her about the honeysuckle plant. Harriet Berry, music historian, last old-time player of the generation that had left Earth. To everyone else, it was simply the song's name. A name that meant this song, nothing more. When I started thinking that way, all the songs took on a strange, flat quality in my head. So many talked about meadows and flowers and roads and birds. The love songs maintained relevance, but the rest might as well have been written in other languages, as far as most people were concerned, or about nothing at all. Mostly, we let the fiddles do the singing. No matter how many times we play a song, it's never the same song twice. The melody stays the same, the key, the rhythm. The notes pattern, their cadence. Still, there are differences. The exact number of fiddles changes. Various players' positions within the group, each with their own fiddle's timbral variances. The locations of the bass, the mandolins, the guitars, the banjos, all in relation to each individual player's ears. To a listener by the snack table or to someone seeking out a recording after the fact, the nuances change. In the minutes the song exists, it is fully its own. That's how it feels to me anyway. Harriet stomped her foot to indicate we'd reached the last go-round for Honeysuckle, and we all came to an end together, except for one of the outer guitarists, who hadn't seen the signal and kept chugging on the last chord. He shrugged off the glares. "Oklahoma Rooster," she shouted, to murmurs of approval. She started the tune and the other fiddlers picked up the melody. I put my bow to the strings and closed my eyes. I pictured a real farm, the way they looked in pictures, and let the song tell me how it felt to be in the place called Oklahoma. A sky as big as space, the color of chlorinated water. The sun a distant disk, bright and cold. A wood-paneled square building, with a round building beside it. A perfect carpet of green grass. Horses, large and sturdy, bleating at each other across the fields. All sung in the voice of a rooster, a bird that served as a wake-up alarm for the entire farm. Birds were the things with feathers, as the old saying went. It was easy to let my mind wander into meadows and fields during songs I had played once a week nearly my whole life. Nelson must have gotten under my skin more than I thought. I found myself adding the weeks and months and years up. 50 times a year, 50 years, more or less. Then the same songs again, alone for practice, or in smaller groups on other nights. The old time broke up at 0300, as it usually did. I rolled my head from side to side, cracking my neck. The music always carried me through the night, but the second it stopped, I started noticing the cramp of my fingers, the unevenness of my shoulders. "What does Oklahoma Rooster mean to you?" I asked Dana Torres as she shook out her knees. "Sorry? What do you think of when you play Oklahoma Rooster?" Torres laughed. "I think CCG, CCC, GC. Anything else, and I fall behind the beat." "Why? What do you think of?" "A bird, a farm, a meadow." "I don't know. Sorry. Weird question." We packed our instruments and stepped into the street, dimmed to simulate night. Back at my quarters, I knew I should sleep, but instead I sat at the table and called up the history database. Wind will rove. Options appeared. Play. Cross-reference to the song database with choices from several old-time recordings we'd made over the years. Sheet music, painstakingly generated by my grandmother and her friends, tapped for all of the appropriate instruments. History. I tapped the last icon and left it to play as I heated up water for a soporific tea. I'd watched it hundreds of times. A video would play on the table. A stern-looking white woman in her 30s, black hair pulled back in a tight ponytail, bangs flat cut across her forehead. She'd been so young then, the stress of the situation making her look older than her years. Harriet Berry, music historian, the first subtitle would say. Then Harriet would appear and begin, "The fiddler Olivia Vandiver and her father Charlie Vandiver came up with this tune in the wee hours of a session in 1974. Except when I returned, the table had gone blank. I went back to the main menu, but this time no options came up when I selected Wind Will Rove. I tried again, and this time the song didn't exist. I stared at the place where it should have been, between Winder Slide and Wolf Creek. Panic stirred deep in my gut, a panic handed down to me. Maybe I was tired and imagining things. It had been there a moment ago. It had always been there, my whole life. The new databases had backups of backups of backups, even if the recordings we called originals merely recreated what had been lost long ago. Glitches happened. It would be fixed in the morning. Just in case, I dashed off a quick message to tech. I drank my tea and went to bed, but I didn't sleep well. Wind Will Rove. Historical reenactment. Wendy Green as Olivia Vandiver, fiddler. We were in our ninth hour play. It had been a really energetic session, and we were all starting to fade, chatting more between songs so we could rest our fingers. I can't remember how the subject came up, but my father brought up a tune called Windy Grove. Nobody else had ever heard of it, and he called us all ignorant Americans. He launched into an A part that sounded something like Spirits of the Morning, but with a clever little lift where spirits descends. My father did things with the fiddle the rest of us could never match, but we all followed as best we were able. The B part wasn't anything like spirits, and we all caught that pretty fast. But the next time the A part came round, it was different again, so we all shut up and let him play. The third time through sounded pretty much like the second, so we figured he had remembered the tune, and we jumped in again. It went the same the fourth and fifth times through. It wasn't until we got up the next day that he admitted he had never quite remembered the tune he was trying to remember, which meant the thing we had played the night before was of his own creation. We cleaned it up, called it Wind Will Rove, and recorded it for the third Vandiver family LP. My grandmother was an astronaut. We are not astronauts. It's a term that's not useful in our vocabulary. Do the people back on Earth still use that word? Do they mention us at all? Are they still there? When our families left, they were called journeyers. 10,000 journeyers off on the incredible journey with the help of a genetic bank, a seed bank, an advisory council. A ship 30 years in the making, held together by a crew of trained professionals, astronauts and engineers and biologists and doctors and the like. Depending on which news outlet you followed, the journeyers were a cult or a social experiment or pioneers. Those aren't terms we use for ourselves, since we have no need to call ourselves anything in reference to any other group. When we do differentiate, it's to refer to the before. I don't know if that makes us the during or the after. My mother's parents met in Texas in the before, while she was still in training. My grandfather liked being married to an astronaut when the trips were finite, but he refused to sign up for the journey. He stayed behind on Earth with two other children, my aunt and uncle, both older than my mother. I imagine those family members sometimes, all those people I have no stories for, generations of them. It's theoretically possible that scientists on Earth have built faster ships by now. It's theoretically possible they've developed faster travel while we've been busy traveling. It's theoretically possible they've built a better ship, that they've peopled it and sent it sailing past us, that they've figured out how to freeze and revive people, that those who stepped into the ship will be the ones who step out, that we will be greeted when we reach our destination by our own ancestors. I won't be there, but my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren might be. I wonder what stories they'll tell each other. This story is verifiable history. It begins, "There was once a man named Morn Brooks." It's used to scare children into doing their homework and paying attention in class. Nobody wants to be a cautionary tale. There was once a man named Morn Brooks. In the fourth year on board, while performing a computer upgrade, he accidentally created a back door to the ship databases. 6 years after that, an angry young programmer named Trevor Doob released a virus that ate several databases in their entirety, destroyed the backups too. He didn't touch the important systems, navigation, life support, medical, seed, and gene banks, but he caused catastrophic damage to the libraries. Music gone, literature, film, games, art history, gone, gone, gone. Virtual reality simulation banks gone, along with the games and the trainings and the immersive recreations of places on Earth. He killed external communications, too. We were alone, years earlier than we expected to be. Severed. For some reason, it's Brooks' name attached to the disaster. Doob was locked up, but Brooks still walked around out in the community for people to point at and shame. Our slang term, Brooked, came from his name. He spent years afterward listening to people say they had brooked exams and brooked relationships. I suppose it didn't help that he had such a good name to lend. Old English, Dutch, German. A hard word for a lively stream of water. We have no use for it as a noun now. No Brooks here. His shipmates still remembered Brooks, though they'd never seen one again. There was a verb form already, unrelated, but it had fallen from use. His contemporaries verbed him afresh. It didn't matter that for 16 years afterward, he worked on the team that shored up protection against future damage, or that he eventually committed suicide. Nobody wanted to talk about Doob or his motivations. All people ever mentioned was the moment the screens went dark and Brooks' part in the whole disaster when they traced it backward. In fairness, I can't imagine their panic. They were still the original journeyers, the original crew, the original advisory council, save one or two changes. They were the ones who had made sure we had comprehensive databases so we wouldn't lose our history and so they wouldn't be without their favorite entertainments. The movies and serials and songs reminded them of homes they had left behind. The media databases meant more to that first generation than I could possibly imagine. They came from all over the earth, from disparate cultures, for some from smaller subgroups. The databases were all that connected them with their people. It's no wonder they reacted the way they did. I do sometimes wonder what would be different now if things hadn't gone wrong so early in the journey. Would we have naturally moved beyond the art we carried, instead of clinging to it as we do now? All we can do is live it out, but I do wonder. I don't teach on Fridays. I can't bounce back from 7 hours of fiddling or from the near all-nighter the way I did at 20 or 30 or 40. Usually I sleep through Friday mornings. This time, I woke at 10, suddenly and completely with the feeling something was missing. I glanced at the corner by the door to make sure I hadn't left my fiddle at the wreck. I showered, then logged on to the school server to see if any students had turned in early assignments. They hadn't. Then checked the notice system for anything that might affect my plans for the day. It highlighted a couple of streets I could easily avoid, and warned that the new Shakespeare and Chinese cultural DBs were down for maintenance. Those alerts reminded me about the database crash the night before. My stomach lurched again as I called up Wind Will Rove. But it was there when I looked for it, right where it belonged. The door chimed. Fridays I had lunch with Harriet. We called it lunch, even though we'd both be eating our first meal of the day. She didn't get up early after the old time either. Usually I cut it pretty close, rolling out of bed and putting on clothes, knowing she'd done the same. I glanced around the room to make sure it was presentable. I'd piled some dirty clothes on the bed, but they were pretty well hidden behind the privacy screen. Good enough. "You broke the deal, Rosie," she said, eyeing my hair as I opened my door. "You showered." I couldn't sleep. She shrugged and slid into the chair I'd just been sitting in. She had a skull cap pulled over her own hair, dyed jet black. Harriet had 30 years on me, though she looked wiry and spry. It had taken me decades to stop considering her my grandmother's friend and realize she'd become mine as well. Now we occupied a place somewhere between mentorship and friendship, history teacher and music historian, fiddle player and master fiddler. I handed her a mug of mint tea and a bowl of congee and a spoon. My dishware had been my grandmother's from Earth. Harriet always smiled when I handed her the chipped Cape Breton Fiddlers Association mug. She held the cup up to her face for a moment, breathing in the minty steam. "Now, tell me why you walked in late last night. I missed you in the second row. Kim Porter took your usual seat, and I had to listen to his sloppy bow technique all night." "Kim's not so bad. He knows the tunes." "He knows the tunes, but he's not ready for the second row. He was brooking rhythms all over the place. You should have called him out on it." "I wouldn't." She cradled the mug in her hands and breathed in again. Lyatt and I hadn't been a couple for years, but she still brought me real mint from the greenhouse, and I knew Harriet appreciated it. "I know. You're too nice. There's no shame in letting someone know his place. Next time, I'll do it." She would, too. She had taken over the old-time enforcer job from my grandmother and lived up to her example. They both sent me back to the outer circles more than once before I graduated inward. "I'll tell you when you're ready, Rosie," my grandmother said. "You'll get there." "You know Wendy would have done it," Harriet said, echoing my thoughts. The nickname jogged my memory again. "Wind Will Rove," I said. "Something was wrong with the database last night. The song was missing." She pushed the cups to the side and tapped the table awake. "Down for maintenance," she read out loud, frowning. She looked up. "I don't like that. I'll go over to Tech myself and ask. She stood and left without saying goodbye. Harriet had a way of saying things so definitively you couldn't help agreeing. If she said you didn't belong in the second row, you weren't ready yet. If she said not to worry over the song issue, I would have been willing to believe her, even though it made me uneasy. Hopefully it was nothing, but her reaction was appropriate for anyone who'd lived through the blackout. I hadn't even gotten around to answering her first question, but I wasn't really sure what I would have told her about Nelson in any case. I went to pick up my grandchildren from daycare, as I always did on Friday afternoons, Natalie's long day at the hospital. If anything could keep me out of my head, it was the mind-wiping exhaustion of chasing toddlers. "Goats?" asked Taylor. She had just turned 2, her brother Jonah 4. "Goats okay with you too, buddy?" I asked Jonah. He shrugged stoically. He didn't really care for animals, preferred games, but we'd played games the week before. "Goats it is." The farm spread across the bottom deck, near the waste processing plant. We took 2 tubes to get there. Jonah turning on all the screens we passed, Taylor playing with my hair. I always enjoyed stepping from the tube and into the farm's relatively open spaces, as big as 8 rec rooms combined. The air out here, pungent and rich, worked off a different circulator than on the living decks. It moved with slightly more force than on the rest of the ship, though still not a wind, not even a breeze. The artificial sun wasn't any different than on the other decks, but it felt more intense. The textures felt different, too. Softer, plants and fur, fewer touch screens. If I squinted, I could imagine a real farm, ahead or behind us, on a real planet. Everything on every other deck had been designed to keep us healthy and sane. I always found it interesting to spend time in a place dedicated to keeping other animals alive. The goats had been a contentious issue for the planners in my grandmother's generation. Their detractors called them a waste of food and space and resources. Wendy was among those who argued for them. They could supplement the synthetic milk and meat supplies. They'd provide veterinary training and animal husbandry skills that would be needed planetside someday, not to mention a living fail-safe in case something happened to the gene banks. It would be good to have them aboard for psychological reasons as well, when people were leaving behind house pets like cats and dogs. She won the debate, as she so often did, and they added a small population of female African pygmy goats to the calculations. Even then, there were dissenters. The arguments continued until the blackout, then died abruptly, along with the idea the journey might go as planned. She told me all of that 3 weeks after my mother left, when I was still taking it personally. "Have you ever tried to catch a goat?" she asked. I hadn't. I'd seen them, of course, but visitors were only supposed to pet them. She got permission, and I spent 20 minutes trying to catch an animal that had zero interest in being caught. It was the first thing that made me laugh again. I always thought of that day when I brought my grandchildren to pet the goats, though I hoped I never had any reason to use the same technique on them. I had wrapped up some scraps for Jonah and Taylor to feed the nippy little things. Once they'd finished the food, the goat started on Taylor's jersey, to her mixed delight and horror. I kept an eye on goat teeth and toddler fingers to make sure everybody left with the proper number. "Miss Clay," somebody said, and I glanced up to see who had called me, then back to the babies and the fingers and the goats. They looked vaguely familiar, but everyone did after a while. If I had taught them, I still might not recognize a face with 20 more years on it. If they didn't spend time on the same decks I did. Miss Clay, I'm Nelson's parent. Other parent. Lee, I think you know Ash. Ash was Harriet's grandkid. They'd refused to play music at all, to Harriet's endless frustration. Lee didn't look anything like Nelson, but then I recalled Harriet saying they had gone full gene bank. The incentives to include gene variants in family planning were too good for many people to pass up. Nice to meet you, I said. I'm sorry if he's been giving you any trouble, Lee said. He's going through some kind of phase. Phase? Sometimes feigning ignorance got more interesting answers than agreeing. He's decided school is teaching the wrong things, says there's no point in learning anything that doesn't directly apply to what will be needed planetside, that it puts old ideas into people's heads when they should be learning new things. I have no idea where he came up with it. I nodded. Do you work down here? Lee gestured down at manure-stained coveralls. He likes it here, though. Farming fits his worldview. But history doesn't. History, classic literature, anything you can't directly apply. I know he's probably causing trouble, but he's a good kid. He'll settle down once he figures out a place for himself in all this. Taylor was offering a mystery fistful of something to a tiny black goat. Jonah looked like he was trying to figure out if he could ride one. I put a hand on his shoulder to hold him back. Tell me about the blackout, I say at the start of the video I made while still in school. 18-year-old me, already a historian. My voice is much younger. I'm not on screen. But I can picture myself at 18, tall, gawky, darker than my mother, lighter than my father. I don't think there was anybody who didn't panic, my grandmother begins. Her purple hair is pulled back in a messy bun, and she is sitting in her own quarters, mine now, with her Cape Breton photos on the walls. Once we understood that the glitch hadn't affected navigation or the systems we rely on to breathe and eat, once it became clear the culprit was a known virus and the damage was irreparable, well, we just had to deal with it. The culprit was a person, not a virus, right? A virus who released a virus. Her face twisted at the thought. I moved back to safer ground. Did everyone just deal with it? That isn't what I've heard. There are a lot of people to include in everyone. The younger children handled it fine. They bounced and skated and ran around the rec rooms. The older ones, the ones who relied on external entertainments, had more trouble and got in more trouble, I guess. She gave a sly smile. But ask your father how he lost his pinky finger if you've never done so. That was when he did it? You bet. 18 years old and some daredevil notion to hitch a ride on the top of a lift. Lucky he survived. He told me a goat bit it off. She snorted. I'm guessing he told you that back when you said you wanted to be a goat farmer when you grew up. No answer from younger me. She shrugged. Or maybe he didn't want to give you any foolish ideas about lift cowboys. He's not a daredevil, though. Not anymore. Not after that. Not after you came along the next year. Anyway, you asked who just dealt with it. And you're right. The kids coped because they had nothing to compare it to, but obviously the main thing you want to know about is the adults. The memory projects. Yes, that's the assignment. Right. So, here you had all these people, born on Earth, raised on Earth. They applied to be journeyers because they had some romantic notion of setting out for a better place. And those first years, you can't even imagine what it was like. The combination of excitement and terror. Anytime anything went wrong, a replicator broke, a fan lost power, anything at all, someone started shouting we had set our families up for certain death. She says certain death dramatically, wiggling her fingers at me. Then crew or logistics or tech showed them their problem had an easy fix, and they'd calm down. It didn't matter how many times we told them we had things under control. Time was the only reassurance. By 10 years in, we had finally gotten the general populace to relax. Everyone had their part to do, and everyone was finally doing it quietly. We weren't going to die if a hot water line went cold one day. There were things to worry over, of course, but they were all too big to be worth contemplating. Same as now, you understand? And we had this database, this marvelous database of everything good humans had ever created, music and literature and art, from all around the world, in 100 languages. And then Trevor Doob had to go and ruin everything. I know you know that part, so I won't bother repeating it. Morn Brooks did what he did, and that Doob fellow did what he did, and all of a sudden, all of these journeyers, with their dream of their children's 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 etc., someday setting foot on a new planet, they all have to deal with their actual children. They have to contemplate the idea the generations after them will never get to see or hear the things they thought were important. That all they have left is the bare walls. They wait, we wait, and wait for the DB to be restored. And they realize, hey, I can't rely on this database to be here to teach those great-great-great-grandchildren. She leans forward. So everyone doubles down on the things that matter most to them. That's when some folks who didn't have it got religion again. The few physical books on board became sacred primary texts, including the ones that had been sacred texts to begin with. Every small bit of personal media got cloned for the greater good. From photos to porn. Don't giggle, but it wasn't much, not compared to what we'd lost. Cultural organizations that had been atrophying suddenly found themselves with more members than they'd had since the journey started. Actors staged any show they knew well enough, made new recordings. People tried to rewrite their favorite books and plays from memory, paint their favorite paintings. Everyone had a different piece. Some closer to accurate than others. That's when we started getting together to play weekly instead of monthly. I thought it was always weekly, Gray. Nope. We didn't have other entertainments to distract us, and we were worried about the stories behind the songs getting lost. The organized memory project started with us. It seemed like the best way to make sure what we wanted handed down would be handed down. The others saw that we'd found a good way to approach the problem and keep people busy, so other memory projects sprung up too. We went through our whole repertoire and picked out the 40 songs we most wanted saved. Each of us committed to memorizing as many as we could, but with responsibility for a few in particular. We knew the songs themselves already, but now people pulled what they knew about them, and we memorized their histories, too, where they came from, what they meant. And later, we were responsible for re-recording those histories and teaching them to somebody younger, so each song got passed down to another generation. That's you, incidentally. I know. Just checking. You're asking me some pretty obvious stuff. It's for a project. I need to ask. Fine, then. Anyhow, we re-recorded all our songs and histories as quick as possible, then memorized them in case somebody tried to kill the DBs again. And other people memorized the things important to them. History of their people, the stuff that didn't make it into the history books. Folk dances, formulae. Actors built plays back from scratch, though some parts weren't exactly as they'd been. And those poor jazz musicians. Those poor jazz musicians. I thought jazz was about improv. It's full of improv, but certain performances stood out as benchmarks for their whole mode. I'm glad we play a music that doesn't set much stock in solo virtuosity. We recorded our fiddle tunes all over again, and the songs are still the songs. But nobody on board could play So What like Miles Davis or anything like John Coltrane. Their compositions live on, but not their performances, if that makes sense. Would have devastated your grandfather if he'd been on board. Anyway, what was I saying? The human backup idea had legs, even if it worked better for some things than others. It was a worst-case scenario. Which two songs did you memorize history for? Unofficially, all of them. Officially, same as you. Honeysuckle and Wind Will Rove. You know that. I know, Gra, for the assignment. Windy Grove, historical reenactment. Marius Smit as Howie McCabe, Cape Breton fiddlemaker. Vandiver wasn't wrong. There was a tune called Windy Grove. My great-grandfather played it, but it was too complicated for most fiddlers. I can only remember a little of the tune now. It had lyrics, too, in Gaelic and English. I don't think Vandiver ever mentioned those. There was probably a Gaelic name, too, but that's lost, along with the song. My great-grandfather grew up going to real milling frolics before machines did the wool shrinking and frolics just became social events. The few songs I know in Gaelic, I know because they have that milling frolic rhythm. It drives them into your brain. Windy Grove wasn't one of those. As far as I know, it was always a fiddle tune, but not a common one because of its difficulty. All I know is the A part in English, and I'm pretty sure I wouldn't get the melody right now. So I'm going to sing it to the melody of Wind Will Rove. We went down to the windy grove, never did know where the wind would go, never too sure when the wind comes back, if it's the same wind that we knew last.